This is Silver Star Bible School for the year 2007. The theme for this week is Building the Ecclesia in Perilous Times. Our brother Carl Perry's sub-theme is I Am Returned to Jerusalem with Mercy. And today's subtitle is Who Is There Among You of All People? And the reading was Ezra chapter 1. Brother Carl, please.
Thank you for the chairman, and good morning, brethren and sisters. It's a great privilege to be amongst you this week to discuss the power and the wonder of the Word of God. I'll be dealing this week, God willing, with the prophecy of Zechariah. And this morning particularly, we're going to look at the background which led to the remarkable predictions that both Haggai and Zechariah made. And I think, brethren and sisters, we have to appreciate the spiritual trauma of those 70 years of captivity. Here was a people that trusted in everything that was around them, the temple, the high priest, the king, the infrastructure of the whole of the city was dependent upon this concept that it would never, ever, ever be destroyed. And the trauma of that destruction and everything they put their trust in was absolutely annihilated. And they saw the high priest butchered in front of them. Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, saw his sons slain in his eyes, and his eyes were burnt out. That was the very last thing that he remembered, the death of his sons. The temple burnt to the ground. No feasts, no joy, no weddings. As Jeremiah said, absolute silence in that blackened city. And the trauma, brethren and sisters, of people who put their trust in the everlasting God, the psychological trauma, as well as the spiritual trauma, was ever present with this people. And you know, you only have to really read the prophecies of Lamentations to understand, appreciate the awfulness of that scene. How doth the city sit solitary? Zion spreadeth forth her hands, and there is none to comfort her. And you only have to read those awful words of a man crushed by his God. No longer forgiveness, no longer reconciliation. God's anger, wrath, judgment dispersed amongst this people. An awful situation. And you see, brethren and sisters, when these captives came back, there had to be this dramatic reassurance that the God of Israel was interested in them and still loved them and still had a plan and purpose with them. Even in the book of Jeremiah, they were saying, as the Babylonians crowded around the city, have God cast away his people? It's almost the language of Romans chapter 11. No, God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. But this people, shocked by the fact that God could remove everything that was holy and precious, was to them an enormous spiritual and psychological trauma. But the thing, brothers and sisters, is that sitting behind all of this simple story of the return from captivity were the high expectations of the prophecies of Isaiah. I don't know whether you're aware of that, but in Isaiah is sitting there these chapters from 41 to 52, which were specifically designed for this generation returning under Ezra, and in fact under Joshua and Zerubbabel. Think about that. Not just the prophecies of Jeremiah were sitting there, but this massive amount of fascinating detail in the prophecies of Isaiah. There's a courtroom drama. We'll look briefly at this morning in Isaiah 41 to 45. Intensely interesting way in which God handles the nations and Israel. In chapters 46 and 47, the desolation of Babylon is very clearly outlined. And finally, in chapters 48 to 52, there are these appeals to the generation, the specific generation, that's about to return to Joshua and under Zerubbabel. Let's come back, shall we, to Isaiah. It really starts in Isaiah 39. You Assyrian had just been defeated. The mightiest world power crushed. 185,000 of them destroyed in a night. And in a moment of weakness, Hezekiah allows the ambassadors of Babylon into his treasure house and shows them all his treasures in his house that he had accumulated. And of course, there was the problem. There was no honor to God. And so God said in Isaiah 39, verse 6, "Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house, that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day, shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith Yahweh. But thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And you know, that would have prompted in the mind of faithful Israelites a number of perplexing paradoxes. How is it that God can deliver from the mighty Assyrian and yet allow the Babylonian to come in and to remove everything from the palace? Is there inconsistency with God here? How could God save in one situation and not in another? And all those complex questions would have arisen in the minds of these people as they listened to those awful words, "Nothing shall be left." You know, there's a vast wilderness between Jerusalem and Babylon. Is that really what that's happened? A vast wilderness between Jerusalem and Babylon. And Isaiah chapter 40 describes in graphic terms of the king arriving back to his people. You know, it wasn't so much Israel returning from captivity to God. It was really an issue of God returning to Israel. And there are dramatic terms, a voice shouting out to the world, "Prepare ye the way of Yahweh in the wilderness." And Isaiah sees the king coming back to Jerusalem. A magnificent picture. A shepherd with young. And Isaiah 40 continues with the power and the majesty and the greatness of the Creator. There is none like him. He sits upon the circle of the earth. The inhabitants of the world are grasshoppers, nations like a drop in the bucket. No one has instructed God. No one has been his counselor. He is the supreme and the mighty God. And you know, brothers and sisters, in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 27, in the middle of this tremendous exaltation of God, there's a little question being asked. "Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from Yahweh, and my judgment is passed over from my God?" And that little verse with those two questions prompts chapters 41 through to 52 of Isaiah, in which God answers that question. What was the question? "My way is hid from Yahweh." Do you know what they were saying? They were saying, brothers and sisters, that God was incapable of understanding the needs of his people. And that the real way was hid from God. And there was no justice in life. "My judgment is passed over." Can you imagine that, brothers and sisters, of people who had just been delivered from the Assyrian, of hearing that the Babylonian captivity would take place, which is 150 years into the future when they would be released, and these people saying, "God doesn't understand." Does he understand, brothers and sisters? Of course he understands. We should never, ever, ever think that our life is too complex, our life is too difficult, the trials are too heavy to bear, that God is unaware of those things. He's aware of everything. Absolutely everything. Is God aware? Most definitely. And so in Isaiah chapter 41, he assembles the nation in this courtroom. It's a tremendous image, isn't it? I mean, everyone's interested in a courtroom drama. Everyone wants to know the judgment of the judge and the witnesses and the back and forth of the arguments. People are interested with that. It draws their attention. From Isaiah 41 and verse 1, God almost, "Keep silence before me." Here's the judge. As he wraps the gavel, as it were, on the rostrum. Keep silence before me, O nations. Here is the world, as it were, crowded into the courtroom. And let the people renew their strength. Let them come near, is the invitation. Then let them speak. I will give you opportunity to present your case. Let them come near together to judgment. What a dramatic opening. Keep silence before me, O islands. Even the very furthest coastlands invited to come to the courtroom session and hear the judgment of God. And the first deliverance of this judge is in verse 2, who raised up the righteous man from the east. Now that's Cyrus. As the trial progresses, the name of the individual is finally released in chapter 44. Cyrus. Now you imagine this, brothers and sisters, that here is the name of the deliverer of Israel issued 140, 150 years before the man conquered Babylon. By name. It's like God saying that in the year 2157, a man named so-and-so will rise up and do something. What an amazing prediction. Who raised up righteousness, as the Hebrews actually is personified, from the east, and called him to his foot, and gave the nations before him, made him rule over kings. What a way to introduce a courtroom scene. And the nations are in disarray. A new conqueror is on the scene. Not another Assyria, surely another Babylon. And Israel also is trembling at the approach of this conqueror. But in verse 8, God says, "But thou, Israel." As he swings the attention away from all those nations crowded in the courtroom, he picks out a single nation. "But thou, O Israel, art my servant. Jacob, whom I've chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend, thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, thou art my servant. I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, yea, will I uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." And the rest of the trial scene, brothers and sisters, goes through comforting, strengthening, persuading Israel, "Don't be afraid, I am with thee." And we're going to see some of those words later on in our exhortation this morning, because they're repeated by the prophets of old in a most interesting way. Do you know, we get to the end of the courtroom scene, it's dramatic because God debunks the idols. He asked the nations to respond, and they're dumbfounded. They've got nothing to say. His argument is very, very simple. I predicted all of these things before they've happened. Now it's your turn. Silence in the courtroom. And we get to the end of Isaiah 44. Verse 28, the set of Cyrus. And there's almost a deafening silence in the room. Cyrus is named, Isaiah 44, verse 28. "He's my shepherd. He shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and the temple thy foundations shall be laid." There's a certainty about that, isn't there? And having silenced the nations, put them to shame, do you know, at the end of Isaiah 45, he turns around to these nations in verse 22, and he says, "Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth." What an amazing judge. Humbling them, silencing them, and then in the end offering them eternal life. That's our God. That is the greatness of our God. When Israel said, "My way is hid from God," God said, "It's not. I'm precisely aware of absolutely everything, and I will bring you back. The nations will be in turmoil. You'll be afraid, but I want you to trust in me, and I'll bring you back." What an amazing thing. We're going to see in our studies, God willing, a number of allusions back to this tremendous section of Scripture, specifically written for a generation 150 years after Isaiah prophesied. What an amazing thing. What a wonderful thing. So you see, brothers and sisters, that the return from Zion, the return to Zion, should I say, as depicted by Ezra, is not some simple story. It is an account in which the defeat of Babylon and the release of his people Israel is, brethren and sisters, a testimony to the faithfulness of God, the righteousness of God, the power of God, the care of God, the love of God, the futility of idolatry, and the vindication of God's righteousness and his redemption. And all of those issues that Isaiah spoke of are embedded in the book of Ezra. It's a remarkable thing. 70 years in captivity does a lot to a people. There would be a generation born that would never have seen the temple, seen a high priest. For 70 years, it was impossible to keep feasts, and particularly the Day of Atonement. There was no national redemption or forgiveness in Babylon. And as the time drew near, when the 70 years which Jeremiah has spoken about was now on the horizon, faithful men like Daniel were on his knees praying earnestly for this time. We have sinned. We have done iniquity. Forgive. 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 And that earnestness, that tremendous prayer of Daniel in chapter 9, was in fact the prayer of all those faithful brethren and sisters who would have appreciated the need for forgiveness. Desperately need for forgiveness as the time drew near. Now in Ezra chapter 1, which we read this morning, we have that tremendously exciting issue. Ezra chapter 1 and verse 1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation. You see the margin, that he caused a voice to pass through all his kingdom and put it also in writing. Yahweh stirred up the spirit of the king of Cyrus. You know, we read that word very quickly. He stirred up the spirit. 130 years before, Isaiah had said in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 17, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them." Jeremiah 50 and 51 there on the screen, "I will raise and cause to come up against Babylon a great nation." It's all the same Hebrew words. Isaiah 41, "Who raised up," we read it this morning, "who raised up the righteous man from the east." Isaiah 45, "I've raised him up in righteousness." Now that simple word which was pulled out of the context of Isaiah and Jeremiah is an amazing thing when you think about it. The Elohim at work behind the scenes, manipulating and maneuvering nations and making sure that there was a man born and his mum just happened to call him Cyrus. Can you imagine the providence behind that? And that this king would become a shepherd, that he would in fact far off in the east there of Elam finally accumulate nations together and have sufficient power and strength to take on Babylon, impregnable Babylon. What an amazing thing. I've stirred him up, and God's spirit was stirred up. Now, who do you think was behind the scenes stirring up this king? Who do you think was behind the scenes? You know, you look at Ezra chapter 1 and verse 2. There is the decree of Cyrus. You can go to the British Museum today. Did we find it, Stephen, when we went there? I don't think we did. But you can find it somewhere in the British Museum today. The very cylinder of Cyrus. The very cylinder of Cyrus. "Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh Elohim of heaven." Where do you think he got that language from? That's not Persian religious language. There's only one man who possibly could have given that information. Daniel the prophet. The record says there that Yahweh Elohim hath given me all the kings of the earth. That's the language of Daniel. Have you noticed that? Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, God has given you a kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar didn't really appreciate that. And here's Cyrus standing up saying that God has given me all kingdom. That's the language of Daniel. Trace it through the concordance and look at that. Fascinating. And says verse 2, he has charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem. Where did he get those words? Who charged him? Where did the charge come from? You know, you imagine Daniel the prophet walking into Cyrus and introducing himself and saying, I've got a prophecy to show you. And unrolling the scroll of Isaiah and showing him in Isaiah 44 and verse 28 and Isaiah 45 verse 1, the very action of Cyrus taking Babylon. He hath charged me. What an amazing thing. What an absolutely amazing thing. Daniel's influence and his prayer have given this man this charge to build again Jerusalem. So you see, brothers and sisters, the real question of Ezra chapter 1 is found for us in verse 3. It's a good question because it challenges every one of us. Who is there among you of all his people? We're not just talking about the building of a literal house. We're talking about the strengthening and building and edifying of the ecclesial house of God. That's what the parable is all about. It's no good sitting here looking at events 2,500 years ago and saying, well, that's interesting, they came back and rebuilt a house. There is a moral dimension to this, brethren and sisters. All of us are busy, or should be busy, constructing and edifying. We have people to build, people to sustain, people to care for. And edification and building and strengthening and encouraging is the task that we have been charged with in the house of God. And that question sitting there on the screen, who is there among you of all his people who are up to the challenge of that? That's the question. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that only 10% of the population of Israel in Babylon returned to the land of their fathers? 10%. We'll prove that a little later on. So there's all these people sitting in Babylon. Good jobs, good houses, trade was flourishing, they sought the peace of the land. 90% of that population said, I don't want to go back and rebuild the house. They came in waves. There's only a fraction of the population. We know that there's a large population of Jews in Babylon because even in the first century, Peter had visited the region and spoken to the Jews in Babylon. So it's a good question, isn't it? And it was the same question, brethren and sisters, that in actual fact had been asked by Isaiah. Who among you will give ear to this? Embedded in the very prophecies of the restoration in Isaiah was a question, who among you will give ear to this? Who's listening about this? And who will hearken and hear for the time to come? What a powerful series of questions that is. Are we listening, brothers and sisters? Are we listening to this appeal the Scriptures is making to us to return and rebuild and to strengthen, to encourage? That's our word. The proverb says that a foolish woman plucketh down her house, but a wise woman builds it up. It takes effort to encourage. It takes sacrifice to go out of your way with a word of comfort and encouragement. It takes courage to stand for things which are right and true in a diplomatic way, in a godly way. And the question is very, very relevant. Who among you will listen to this? His God, said verse 3, be with him. What an amazing sentence. If you're prepared to stand up for the challenge, if you're prepared to understand the importance of that, his God, your God, my God, will be with us. Do we believe that, brothers and sisters? Do we believe that? As we read in Isaiah 41, fear not, I am with thee, be not dismayed. Why? Because I am thy God. You know, the power behind that is immense. Now, this is the creator and sustainer of heaven and earth, the power that keeps the universe in existence, saying, I am your God. You know, have we ever stepped back and thought of the immensity of that, brothers and sisters? The immensity of that? I am thy God. And if you're prepared to listen to what I have to say, his God will be with him. Now this, brothers and sisters, is coming out of the mouth of Cyrus. Now, who prompted that decree? Who did the wordsmithing, as it were? Who drafted the decree? His God be with him. It had to be Daniel. Framing this tremendous thing. Let him go up to Jerusalem, says verse 3, which is in Judah, just in case you have forgotten. And build the house of Yahweh Elohim of Israel. He is the God which is at Jerusalem. And whoever remaineth in any place where he sojourneth. I don't know what's happening here, but it's trying to scan my viruses. I hope it doesn't find anything. Whosoever remaineth. So, you know, there were people who could stay behind, and Daniel was asking for them to contribute. To contribute to the work. You know, it's very similar, isn't it, to the Lord's words. You know, sometimes when the work goes forth, all we can do is just offer a glass of cold water. We may be incapacitated. We may be unable to do the forefront, or what's perceived to be the forefront of the work. And suddenly we become very discouraged by that. And the Lord says, you don't need to be discouraged by that. Even if you're frail and elderly and not well or incapacitated or unable to help, just a cup of cold water is sufficient to demonstrate your support behind the work. What a tremendous encouragement. And it's the same here, that whoever remaineth, if you can't go back to Jerusalem, if you feel that you're infirm or are incapable, at least support the work with silver and gold, beasts for the house. Now you can imagine that decree hitting the streets of Babylon. You can imagine the buzz of excitement as the city had fallen to this new power, of people unearthing the rolls again and looking at their signs of the times documents and the appeals of Isaiah to go back. And therefore it is a wonderful encouragement to see in verse 5 the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, with all them whose spirit God had stirred, raised to go up to build the house of Yahweh, which is at Jerusalem. It's the example of the chief. But it's brethren and sisters whose spirit God has raised. The mind needs to be elevated to grasp spiritual things and to understand the importance of the calling that God has called us to. He raised their minds. He lifted them. And forefront in the work were the elders, those who gave the lead and the charge, who stirred up the rest of the congregation who were going back. because it's leaders, brothers and sisters. It's leaders who influence immensely, not so much by the things they say, by the things they do. And to do that, the spirit has to be elevated. It would be very easy for these people to say, well, I'm comfortable in Jerusalem. I don't really need to go back. For those people that had a higher vision, God was prepared to work with them. Now, verse 6 of Ezra says this. All they that were about strengthened their hands. Now that is straight out of Isaiah 41. We read that this morning. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will help thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Now there, sitting in Isaiah, is the language of Ezra chapter 1 verse 6. How did God strengthen them? Can you imagine, brothers and sisters, where the decree goes out and people are excited about this and as you count the numbers, 10%. Oh, 10%. But sitting behind that are many, many more people. In fact, Gentiles, in verse 6, all they that were about them, these are in fact inclusive of Gentiles, were supportive of the word. And as this 10%, this remnant of the nation, felt perhaps a bit uneasy about the lack of numbers, they saw this massive amount of support come from all people, including Gentiles. You can imagine how much strength they received from that. God was behind it, strengthening their hand. What an amazing thing. Now, as we read Ezra chapter 1 this morning, Benison, did you notice that the chapter contains 11 verses? And verses 7 through to 11, almost half the chapter, focus on these things called vessels. Now you think about this, and this I think is the essence of Bible studies, to ask yourself the question, why? I mean, here we have an international decree, like an earthquake blasting through the world, stirring up the Jewish people to come back to Israel. And in the context of this international, amazing decree, we have half a chapter talking about spoons and snuff dishes and vessels. And why is that? Why is that, brothers and sisters? There is a theme coming through Ezra. I called it the numbered vessels. You see, verse 9 says, the number of them, 30 charges of gold, 1,000 charges of silver, 9 and 20 knives. 29 knives? They even counted the number of knives? 30 basins of gold, silver basins of a second sort, 410, imagine counting all those out, 410. Another vessels of 1,000, all the vessels of gold, of silver, 5,400, all counted, all accounted for. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up with them of the captivity that were brought up from Babylon to Jerusalem. Now, why are we interested all the way through Ezra of the numbered vessels? What's missing is the furniture. The big furniture. Where are the 10 lampstands we read of this morning in the reading? The 10 lavers? The molten sea that was cut up? The Ark of the Covenant? No mention whatsoever. But the vessels, the small, insignificant vessels are mentioned. Because, brothers and sisters, there is a theme. You see, Ezra wrote the book of Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And he has this amazing theme of the vessels going in and out of the house of God. When the nation was righteous, the vessels were counted in the temple. when the nation was wicked, the temple was sacked, and the vessels disappeared. And in the book of Ezra, you have these vessels moving in and out of the house of God, an amazing theme, dependent upon the righteousness or the wickedness of the nation. All these vessels, says verse 11, were with them of the captivity, numbered. Now look at Ezra chapter 2 and verse 2. Which came with Zerubbabel, Joshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Realiah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mizpah, Bigvai, Reum, Baanah, the number of the men of the people of Israel. Now can you see the parallel the record is making? The numbered vessels are with Sheshbazzar, who's Zerubbabel, and in Ezra chapter 2, the number of the men that came with them, they're paralleled for a very, very simple reason. Let's come to 2 Timothy chapter 2. Those vessels represent people. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Let's read this. Verse 20. But in the great house, there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also of wood and earth, some to honor, some to dishonor. If a man therefore purge himself from these, that's the things of the previous verses, verse 19, if he purges himself from all of these things, he shall be a vessel to honor, and sanctified and meet for the master's use, prepared for every good work. So here's the point. Sometimes in ecclesial life, we feel very small, very neglected, and very alone. It's like the question of Isaiah 40, isn't it? My way is hid from God. Is God really interested in me? And what Ezra chapter 1 is saying, brothers and sisters, in all those people that came back from captivity, the vessels were numbered even down to the smallest, seemingly insignificant piece of furniture, the vessels. Every single one of them was numbered and remembered. Think about that. You might feel like a spoon or a snuff dish. Smallest vessel in the whole of the tabernacle and temple arrangements, but it's still numbered, it's still remembered, it's never ever forgotten. I find it a tremendous consolation. 70 years of desolation, the destruction of the whole Jewish commonwealth, and God is making sure that all the little vessels, those who put their trust in Him, numbered, recorded, and kept, and brought across into Babylon, and their families back to the land. I find that absolutely powerful. The vessels, honored, cleansed, useful for every good work. You put things in vessels, you use vessels to serve. That's our lot. And God remembers the smallest of us, even down to 29 knives. Amazing. And that's why, brothers and sisters, in Isaiah 52 and verse 11, as the people poured out of Babylon, the prophet Isaiah said, "Be ye clean that bear the vessels of Yahweh." No one likes a dirty pot. No one likes an unwashed spoon. Be ye clean. They're the vessels of God. There is a holiness, an expectation of holiness from God in the vessels to serve in the house. What an amazing thing. When we come to the second chapter of Ezra, we come across a man called Zerubbabel. Now these are the children of the province which came with Zerubbabel. He's called Sheshbazzar in chapter 1, but he's given his other name in chapter 2. His name's interesting because it means sown in Babylon. Like a seed planted in the darkness of Babylon. And it's very interesting that Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 3, in the context of all of these predictions about the restoration, says, I will pour water upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground, and I will pour my spirit upon thy seed. And here's a man whose name means God has sown. Isn't that interesting? Forgotten? Alone, in difficult circumstances, there's a little seed here. And God poured his spirit upon that seed and it blossomed to produce a branch, which you'll see later on in the book of Zechariah. Now what's interesting about Ezra chapter 2 is that if you love genealogies, this is the chapter for you. Name after name after name after name, but very interesting. Let's look at some of these issues. Did you know that when Zerubbabel came back, he came back with 12 men? He's of the house of Judah with 12 men. This is typical, isn't it, of the restoration of Israel under the Lord and his disciples, 12 thrones of Israel. And what's fascinating about this whole section of Scripture is that, brothers and sisters, these people are virtually unknown in the record of God. You'll rarely find these people mentioned prior to this chapter. They're the small vessels coming back, the unknowns. And we find that there is a deliberate pattern in which the names are declared. See, we've got here, for example, verse 3 to 19, 17 family groups, 15,000 people. We have here 15 verses talking about 22 communities. 8,500 people. But as we go down the list, we find that the number of people becomes smaller and smaller, but the detail becomes greater and greater. So we find, brothers and sisters, look at these. In verse 40, two orders of Levite. 341, not 340, not 345, not rounded up, not rounded down, 341, every vessel counted. And the Levites, tragically, who should have known better, are in the minority. Singers from the house of Asaph in chapter 2 and verse 41, 228 of them. There was no house to sing in. And can you imagine these people who normally were thankful and joyful and singing kind of people who knew the Psalms of David coming to the blackened hole of Jerusalem? That takes faith. We find in verse 42 there are six families of the gatekeepers. There were no gates. These were the sons of Korah, an amazing group of people. And do you know that the sons of Korah composed a number of psalms which were post-exilic, that is, they were after the captivity. Some of these 139 men spoke psalms which are recorded for us in the Psalms of Israel. 35 families, look at this detail, from verse 43 to verse 58, look at all these verses. 25, 26 verses for only 35 families, for only 392 people. Look at the detail given there. Why is that? These people are amazing people. They're called in the record Solomon's servants and Nethinim. The word Nethinim means the given ones. Now I want you to think about the spiritual mentality of these people whose spirit God had raised. In the book of Ezekiel, God had said through Ezekiel, I will overturn, 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 it shall be no more until he come whose right it is. The throne, the majesty, the glory of all the line of David stood for, finished. No more palace, No more king. And yet Solomon's servants, who were palace officials, who were used upon waiting upon the majesty and glory of the king, came back in full realization that it would never ever be reestablished in their time. That's faith. And the Nephilim, the given ones, these were the Gibeonites. Remember the Gibeonites? The royal cities of Canaan that had deceived Joshua. And these are made the hewers of wood and drawers of water. Friends and sisters, if you were given the job of sweeping this floor for every single class, day in and day out, for the rest of your life, and you were removed from that work and you were taken into captivity, and someone said, it's time to go back, sweep the floor again. Would you go back? Would you go back? To hew the wood and to draw the water, to do the most menial tasks, would you go back? These men did. Astounding group of people. This is voluntary service. This is the service of love. This is a spirit which is raised. Now it's Isaiah chapter 6. We haven't got time this morning to look at this. It's Isaiah chapter 6 that says a tenth shall return, the holy seed. They were the root and the germinating foundation of the rest of the nation. Only 10%, a tenth shall return. But amongst those people are remarkably faithful men and women. These are the kind of people that need to serve in the house and build the house and restore again the foundations of truth and righteousness and peace and mercy. What an amazing parable, isn't it, brothers and sisters? What an amazing parable. These came back. In Ezra chapter 3 and verse 1, we read this. The record says that when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man. That's interesting. They were in their cities, busy rebuilding, and without any direct command from Joshua or Zerubbabel or God himself, they felt this need to come together as one single man. It's a different group of people, isn't it, to those who went into captivity. A totally different group. They are as one man. And we'll only ever build and edify and encourage if we do so unitedly. What unifies people together is not just a common cause and a common vision. But as James said, it's sowing righteousness to yield the fruits of peace. You see, I can contend earnestly for the faith, but if I'm rude and arrogant and contentious, I've lost the whole point of contending for the faith. Unity and oneness is not just a common cause which we have together to build and to strengthen, to encourage, but to do so in righteousness and peace. There's a challenge. And this need to come together, that we feel at this school this week, was very similar to the need that these people had to draw together and be united as one man. The last time they had heard that expression, one man, was from the mouth of Daniel, when Daniel chapter 10 had the vision of the one man, the man of the one. And here's the reality of that. The reality of a united people. They gather themselves together at Jerusalem. You imagine that meeting. gates burnt to cinders, the wall blackened through smoke, timbers askew across the building site, the walls smashed to pieces. The absolute feeling of depression as you walk into that city as one man, and all these people looking at this and feeling that, having the great high expectations of Isaiah, which spoke about God opening rivers in the wilderness and bringing them together as one people and reestablishing their glory once more, and they're looking at this place. It's one thing to be depressed and upset and deflated, but it's another thing in verse 2 to stand up. Then stood up Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and builded the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it's written in the law of Moses, the man of God. These are people who stand up to be counted. And I want you to notice that it's kings and priests together. Zerubbabel of the line of David and his brethren, and Joshua the line of Levi and his brethren. Imagine that. Future kings and priests working together to build the house, because you need both those qualities to build a house. You need integrity and honesty and justice and judgment, the kingly line, and you need compassion and mercy and forgiveness and long-suffering in the priestly line. And you get those two lines together, brothers and sisters, and those qualities blended together, then the house can be built. And the first thing they do is they build the altar. Quite a job to put it back on its bases, to recreate it upon its same spot, to clear the rubble away and to rebuild that. And I want you to notice, brothers and sisters, that there is a distinctive necessity to do everything just right. You see, verse 2 says, they did this as it's written in the law of Moses, the man of God. In verse 4, they kept the Feast of Tabernacles as it is written, according to the custom. The record says also in verse 10, after the ordinance of David. Now here's a different kind of people. Before they went into captivity, their altars were to their gods. The law of God was forsaken, but this group is altogether different. It's obedient, and everything is done meticulously according to the word of God, according to that which is written, according to the custom, according to what David had established. Everything's precise. They are definitely a different group of people. They set, says verse 3, the altar upon his basis. Let's read verse 3. They set the altar upon his basis for fear was upon them because of the people of those countries, and they offered burnt offerings thereon unto Yahweh, even burnt offerings morning and evening. Now isn't that interesting, brothers and sisters? As they assembled there in that blackened hole of a city, and the word had got out that the nations were now suspicious of their circumstances, suspicious of their intentions. This defenseless people was standing there looking at this and thinking, I'm afraid, but I need to build the altar of burnt offering. That's an interesting response. Fear was upon them. You know, the altar of burnt offering is a symbol of dedication. Now, what is interesting is it didn't say they offered sin offerings or trespass offerings or meal offerings. They offered burnt offerings. And I'm sure we know that the burnt offering is a symbol of total dedication. To give your all. How do you conquer fear? You give your all. Every part and fiber of your being, your life, morning and evening, given to God. Now, isn't that interesting the way that's done? And we've read this morning in Isaiah 41, Jacob, fear thou not. How did the prophet Isaiah, well, we know, of course, but how did the prophet Isaiah know that this generation coming back would be fearful and afraid? And they were. Don't be afraid, says God. Now, can you imagine, Benson, that scene of these people standing before this depressing scene, fearful of what's about to happen, and men like Joshua getting up and saying, we need to build the altar of God, to give ourselves wholly to God, possibly even quoting the words of Isaiah, fear thou not. You can't manifest faith if you have fear. They're exact opposites. That's what the Lord often said, fear not. Go on believing. Isn't it interesting the way that's done, brothers and sisters? To conquer fear, give yourself wholly to God in His cause. And says the record in verse 4, they kept the Feast of Tabernacles. In Exodus chapter 23 and verse 16, the record says, when thou hast gathered in thy labors in the field. They'd only just come out of Babylon. There was not time to put a harvest in. And yet the Lord had said, thou shalt keep the Feast of Tabernacles when thou hast gathered all thy labors out of the field. How can you keep that feast with these booths when there are no labors? For one very, very simple reason. God was at work. Their hands would produce nothing. This restoration, this reconstruction, this rebuilding again was something, brothers and sisters, which they weren't doing out of their own labor and out of their own strength. The point is, as we've got here, that God was at work. God was at work here. He was the one who, as the record says in Isaiah 41, you're my workmanship. I'm working with you. And the other thing, brothers and sisters, about the Feast of Tabernacles is this. The Leviticus 23 says, thou shalt rejoice. Deuteronomy says, thou shalt surely rejoice. And there is no joy recorded at all. No joy is mentioned. In fact, in our readings in Nehemiah, it's distinctly different from the Feast of Tabernacles in Nehemiah 8, where it distinctly is said they did rejoice. These predictions of joy, which Isaiah had mentioned in those redemption prophecies, were still that. It was a mixed feast. A very mixed feast, but they kept it. The spirit wasn't quite there, the spirit of rejoicing wasn't there, because there was still work to be done. But nevertheless, brothers and sisters, they kept that feast. They kept it to the very end. Chapter 3 verse 5 says this. Everyone that willingly offered themselves a freewill offering unto Yahweh. That's the spirit. There's nothing so more disappointing in ecclesial life. To ask a brother and sister to do something and get all the excuses under the sun. Oh, I'm too busy. Nope, not convenient. Nope, gotta go. Sorry, not really interested. That's not the spirit that God has raised. Our service to our God and to each other has got to have this sense of willingness. A free will offering. When you're asked to do something and it's not convenient, do it. When you're asked to do something and you don't perhaps feel well or in the right frame of mind, still do it. Be generous in your support. Be generous, magnanimous in your service. That's what God's after, brothers and sisters. He doesn't want grudging kind of things. He doesn't want us to say, I suppose, or I guess. Where's the joy in that? The house is successfully built when people freely give themselves to God as a free will offering. And the time came, brothers and sisters, when at last the foundation of the house was laid. Altar first, foundation next. The priests in their apparel, says chapter 3 and verse 10. That's interesting. Where did they get those garments from? They had to be made in Babylon, because they certainly weren't taken from the dead priests 70 years before. The people were ready. With the joy of trumpets, making a joyful noise before their king. There was no king on the throne, but there's a king in heaven. Chapter 3 and verse 10 says also, they sang with trumpets and cymbals. The last time trumpets and cymbals were used in the house of God was in fact a very significant occasion. Let's come back to 2 Chronicles chapter 5. You can see that they were looking back in the record and trying to find some way in which they could emulate the glory and the greatness of the first temple. In 2 Chronicles 5, we have the ceremony that introduced the first temple, the glorious temple of Solomon. Look at this in verse 12. And by the way, in verse 11, both courses of priests were present. Everyone was there. They had this shift arrangement where morning and evening they changed the shift of the Levites and priests, both there together. 24 groups of priests, 24 elders. And verse 12, the Levites, which were the singers, all of them, with Asaph and Heman of Jeduthun, with their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps, stood at the east of the altar, and with them 120 priests, sounding with trumpets. Can you imagine that? You know, you've probably heard in a symphony orchestra the piercing quality of a single trumpet. 120 trumpets. Can you imagine the enormous piercing sound of that? Verse 13, it came even to pass as the trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Yahweh. And when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals, there's an expression in Ezra, the trumpets and cymbals, and instruments of music, and praise Yahweh, saying, for he is good, and for his mercy endureth forever. Then the house was filled with the cloud, even the house of Yahweh. What's that saying? When you get everybody in your ecclesia as one, united as one, praising and giving thanks to God as one, that then and only then the house can be filled with God's glory. What an amazing section of scripture. So when those people stood in Ezra chapter 3 upon the foundations, just a slab of concrete, the blocks of the foundations, and they reenacted, brothers and sisters, with the trumpets and the cymbals as one man, though the glory wasn't there, the grandeur wasn't there, their spirit was there, as they saw in vision the absolute essentialness of unity to build the house. With the trumpets and with the cymbals, they reenacted that amazing incident of Solomon. And people did respond. But you see, brothers and sisters, that as the work continued, God now tested their resolve. He does that, doesn't he? You make a resolve, God tests it. You make a determination to leave this Bible school with some resolutions, God will put those resolutions to the test. And the enemies around decided that it was time for them to contribute to the work. And Ezra chapter 4, if we turn to that, they came and they said, look, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. We sacrifice to him. Since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asher, we've brought us up hither. We're with you. We're religious. You're religious. You worship Yahweh, we worship Yahweh. For those who didn't really have their eyes opened and really understood the hybrid nature of the Samaritan religion, which, yes, they did worship God, plus about 3,000 other idols, it was a very, very subtle response. An assistance to help. Who knocks back assistance to help? We seek your God as ye do. A number of years later, Zechariah the prophet had just commented on that and said that one day people will assist the building of the house, but they will do so with the right spirit. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another saying, let us go speedily to pray before Yahweh and to seek Yahweh of hosts. I will also go. Yea, many people and strong nations shall come to seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before Yahweh, and they'll be accepted in that day because the whole basis is different. But it wasn't the right time when this offer was made. We seek God. No, you don't. And the response came back in Ezra chapter 4, you have nothing to do with us. What a grand response. So Young's literal translation says, not for you and for us. What agreement, says Paul in 2 Corinthians 6:16, what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? None. You cannot introduce into your ecclesial rebuilding program idolatry. Covetousness is idolatry. Anything that takes away our devotion and singleness of worship is idolatry. It comes in many forms, some subtle, some less subtle. You cannot build the house with that in mind. Sort your life out, then you can help build the house. You have nothing to do with us. To build a house unto our God, but we ourselves together, or as the Hebrew is, unitedly. Unitedly, as one man. Well, time passed, and the resolution to build was put to great pressure. Would they succumb? And tragically, brothers and sisters, they did. Here's an interesting thing. In Ezra chapter 4, verse 9 to 10, there was a universal challenge of 10 nations. Zechariah later comments on that when he says 10 men of all nations shall take hold of the scepter of Judah. But initially, brothers and sisters, there were 10 nations in the whole of the Persian Empire which put pressure on the Jewish people. So you see, this incident of the enemies writing back to the power in Persia was not just some localized event of a couple of ragtag Samaritans. This had international support. And just to make sure that we understand the international controversy that was being here, Ezra uses the expression, the rest of the nations. We're talking about a global and universal anti-Semitism here, which says, stop the work. The pressure's really on. The pressure is really on. No wonder they were afraid. This was a massive, concerted effort from the fringes of the Persian Empire, the rest of the nations, saying, stop the work. And tragically, brothers and sisters, as we leave our study this morning, the work ceased at the end of chapter 4. Now here's the challenge. Here is the challenge, brothers and sisters. When the prophet Isaiah in chapter 43 and verse 13 has said, yea, before the day was, I am he, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand, I will work, and who shall let it? Who's going to win this contest? The world? The 10 nations? Or a God who has said, I will work, and who can prevent it? There's the challenge. And though, brothers and sisters, the work had ceased, brothers and sisters, faithfulness had ebbed. This initial resolution to rebuild and to reconstruct had now been snuffed out by this opposition. This year passed, and the work just finally tapered off. And God's almighty decree had said, I will work, and who can prevent it? And there's the challenge that we leave our morning session with. Who's going to win the challenge? The world, or the creator of heaven and earth? We'll wait for our morning exhortation to see who wins.